The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, by police, and the deaths of Freddie Gray and Eric Garner in police custody, America's underlying racial inequality has been thrust into the spotlight. While thousands of people protested or shared opinions about the brutality, others stood on the sidelines, having no idea how to talk about race. Among them, middle-class white Americans who'd be quick to say they aren't racist and think, this is not my issue or mess to clean up. Some may consider themselves colorblind, but remain oblivious to the experiences of people of color. Many are just afraid of saying the wrong thing. Debbie Irving grew up with the values and inherent privileges of her New England WASP class. She's now a racial justice advocate. Her memoir, Waking Up White, follows her realization that believing she's a good person with the empathy and energy to help people of color actually perpetuated her clueless notions of race. Debbie Irving, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So what does Waking Up White mean?
For me, it means waking up to the fact that I'm part of a history and a set of housing and lending and education and ongoing systems that through history have simultaneously advantaged white people. And I'm a member of the white race. I can't help but have benefited from that. And I knew nothing about it. So waking up means learning what I didn't know I didn't know.
And this began a long time ago, a question you asked your mother when you were just 5 years old. What happened to all the Indians? Now, what did she tell you, and what does that reveal about your upbringing?
She said to me, they drank themselves to death.
Wow.
And it's an appalling answer, and I will tell you that my mother was a wonderful person. She was highly educated. Private school, Smith College, empathetic, warm, never spoke poorly about people behind their back. And she said to me, you know, they were lovely people, and they just couldn't handle it. It brought them down. And what it reveals is the inherited ignorance, because she's not alive for me to ask, where did you ever get that story? But I can imagine, because I believed it when she said it to me. I believe that she believed it from someone else who told her, and maybe that person had very scarce information they were operating on. That is a tiny piece of a larger truth, but without the larger truth, that tiny piece paints a picture that portrays Indians as weak, and that is not the case.
Well, growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts, you learned, like many other WASPs, to stifle your feelings. Kind of grew up with this attitude of optimism, which was very different than that of those who, people of color in America, who are prepared for a hostile world. I'm thinking of, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates in his recent memoir writes about his father beating with him with a belt and saying, you know, either I can beat him or the police.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did that mean, having that attitude of optimism?
Well, it meant a lot of things. You know, for me, in addition to the world, the white bubble of the white suburb I was growing up in, the world was coming to me through television shows like Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and The Brady Bunch. And, you know, the biggest problems that were ever presented to me were solved in 30 minutes or less. And it also meant if I feel that I am in a world where anything is possible, that gives me a lot of wingspan in terms of dreaming and taking risks. And I did not have to worry when I stepped out of the house that I needed to be looking over my shoulder, or that I didn't have to contend because of my skin color with low expectations. I did have to do a little bit of that as a female, but never did I have to worry that people would think I was not smart or that I was uppity because of my skin color.
So much later, the awakening begins for you at a class at Wheelock College, and you eventually, in this book, you point to understanding whiteness as being a key to understanding racism. So what does whiteness mean to you?
Well, I think, so what's important to understand is that I spent 48 years thinking race and racism belonged to black and brown people, and I never thought to look within myself for answers. And what whiteness means to me is that it is the social construct that our country, that the United States of America, is founded on. And there was a legal category, white, that was invented in order to preserve resources and rights for white people. And so whiteness means all of that. And it means, if you look at the history of immigration, whiteness plays a huge role because it became paramount for anybody coming to this country, whether or not they could be considered white. So Italian, Irish, Jews eventually were considered white. Other people who, we see it with the Latino population today, all kinds of Asian populations, lobbied to be considered white and they weren't. And so they were denied citizenship and they were subject to all kinds of stereotypes. But whiteness also includes all of the cultural norms that hold that in place. So avoidance of conflict is a key one. So if it becomes normalized to not pose agitating questions in public, and the risk of doing that can ostracize you, you can lose your job, you can lose your status in a community, then we're not able to challenge the status quo. And that's a key component of whiteness.
And beyond the attitudes are norms, there is a great deal of institutional racism that has maintained privilege for white people. What are some examples of that?
Well, there are current examples, but I think there's no better institutional example than the GI Bill and the way it played out after World War II. It feels long ago, but its remnants are largely responsible for what we see going on in neighborhoods that get fingered as violent and irresponsible, you know, ghettos today. Those were laid down in the mid-1900s with housing and lending policies, where that lenders would not lend in neighborhoods where even one or two black families lived, whereas they would lend at low rates in neighborhoods like Winchester. So when you take a look at the GI Bill, this is how multiple institutions intersect. GI Bill says, hey, you World War II veterans coming home from the war, we're going to give you free higher education and low interest rate federal government-backed loans to buy a home. My father took advantage of both of those, Harvard Law School, home in Winchester. That bill was not available to 1 million, most of the 1 million black GIs who had also fought in World War II, because the loans would not go into a neighborhood where even one or two black families lived. And then on the education front, there was a quota system, and those spots filled up immediately. And there's even more to the story, but to give you a short version, that's how institutional racism works.
Well, I know that you are trying to normalize the conversation and get real with entangling and engaging in white privilege. But why do I feel weird and even suspect as one middle-class white woman talking to another? I'm in New Hampshire, among the whitest of states, about the realization of white privilege.
Why do you feel awkward? Is that the question when you're talking about it?
I guess that's a question for me, but you went through it, so I'd like to hear about your experience.
And I will tell you that white people all over the country are confessing to me, yeah, I feel that too. It's because we were taught not to talk about it. And if you're not talking about a subject, you have no language for it. Then you layer onto that there is this norm about creating conflict and looking good. You know, you don't want to appear stupid, or you don't want to be offensive. You don't want to appear to be a boat rocker. So even bringing up the subject can be, uh-oh, here's a rabble rouser. Then you get in, I feel like it's a little bit like you learn a new language and you know how to say hello to someone, but as soon as they say something back to you, you go into paralysis because you don't know anything else other than hello. So that once you enter into these conversations, they are very likely to get rocky and contentious. And that if you're taught not to engage in conflict, you don't develop conflict navigation skills or even conversational skills that help us navigate through conflict. So I think that's why. And the other thing for me is that having been exposed to racial stereotypes my whole life, I can be sitting across the table talking to a good friend or colleague, even now, even after all the work I've done, and bubbling up into my head will be these negative stereotypes. And it makes me feel like a jerk. And oh my God, you know, what if one of these words slips out of my mouth when I'm in mid-conversation? So that's another layer. And those internalized ideas, images, words, that is natural. That does not make us bad, but it does, if, until we get in touch with them and say, wow, look at what all those cartoons and all that lack of exposure to positive images of Black and brown people, look what it's done to me. If you can't get to the point of acknowledging that, then you sort of stuff down those biases and deny they exist. And I think that actually makes them try to bubble up harder and make those moments more awkward.
Well, I think it also makes me feel very self-conscious because we're taking this issue of race and in a way making it about us, the white people, again.
So there's a term for that, and that's called centering whiteness. And, you know, it threatens to, you know, recenter whiteness in a way that now white is the focus once again. And yet, it is crucial to understand how whiteness operates. If whiteness were not a thing, if race had not been invented by white people, racism, which is the ability to use power to enforce policy around race, if that had not been invented by white people, there would be nothing to discuss. And so it is the context. If we don't think of it as a center, but we think of it as the landscape, it is crucial to understand the landscape that creates discrimination, poverty, the achievement gap in education, differential lifespans. I know you had a show on last week talking about the way racism shows up in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Every sector of our society suffers from a racial divide in terms of how people experience it and in terms of what outcomes are. There is one connecting landscape for all of that, one context for that, and that is whiteness. And that's why whiteness is so crucial to understand.
I'm speaking with Debbie Irving about her experience of growing up sheltered from genuine understanding of institutional racism. Her memoir recounts a concerted effort to engage with her inherited privilege and beliefs and judgments, which are sometimes exposed in humiliating ways. I asked her to share one of those examples with us and what she took away from it.
Yeah, and let me also add that I really identified as a good person because of that impulse. I thought that was what made me a good person, that desire to help and fix. And, well, one example, and this is in the book, is I was the general manager of First Night, and one of my charges was to bring together the multiple neighbors, the diverse neighborhoods of Boston, into a single New Year's Eve celebration. And I felt completely entitled to design the program without the input of a lot of people. And I had access, because of the social circles I'd grown up in, I had access to write grants and get money and, you know, raise the money to create these great inner city, quote-unquote, inner city programs. And my idea was, wouldn't it be great to partner these after-school programs, who were disproportionately Black and brown children, with artists who were disproportionately white, have them create artworks and bring them down to the New Year's Eve celebration. So I thought that that was a great idea, and in some ways it was a good idea, but what I did not anticipate and was really hard for me to hear was that it was terrifying for those people who had been, for the children and the families, you know, their parents and their siblings, their aunts and uncles who had come down to the festival. It was terrifying for them to come into a huge white crowd, so that maybe making the art was interesting to them, but the actual experience of coming to the event was terrifying. That really sobered me.
You live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ask yourself, you know, despite living in this multicultural environment, do I always end up with white people? What is it that keeps white people in their enclaves. You mentioned earlier, you know, the fear of messing up or fear of saying the wrong thing. Is that it?
I think that's a part of it. You know, so we're talking about just that awkwardness. I'm afraid of saying something stupid or offensive. Well, when you're wanting to kind of let down your guard and hang out with your closest friends and family, that's not a time when you choose to be around people that you feel sort of an underlying nervousness around. So that was part of it for me. But the other part of it is people of color really, you know, they have to be with white people. If they're trying to put together a living, they're educating themselves in white spaces, they're working in white spaces. When they need to unwind at the end of a day, they don't want to be around white people who really don't understand what racism is, how it works, or how even the most well-intentioned white person can be sort of oppressive. And, you know, white cultural norms are oppressive. We talk about the weather. We talk about light things. We deny racism exists. We say, oh, we're all the same. I love all people. We're all just human. Those are things that are surprisingly offensive. And so there's a culture clash. And at the end of the day, I think people of color are exhausted. They need to refuel. They do not need to be hanging out with white people. And that's, I'm not speaking for all people of color or all white people, but I think that that's a trend that keeps us separate. And I will tell you, my life has changed drastically. As soon as I could start talking about racism from my experience as a white person, as opposed to going, oh, that sounds terrible, what you have to go through. As soon as I could own my piece of it, all my relationships with friends of color changed almost overnight.
But isn't there a danger of saying, you know, I want to live in a multicultural world with other people, of sort of crediting yourself with having all of these multicultural friends? You know, isn't that in itself a danger of stepping over this line of, oh, I belong, I'm cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like I'm accumulating friends and look at me, like it's a badge of honor. Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a danger, and I think that I was guilty of that earlier. I think it really changes when I hear the term multicultural, it means white as much as anything else. As soon as I start to say multicultural isn't something that belongs to other people, ethnicity isn't something that belongs to other people, race isn't something that belongs to other people only, but I'm a part of that formula. And in fact, my race, my ethnicity, my cultural piece that I bring to a multicultural environment is crucial for me to stay aware, be on top of, and be aware of. Then you move from accumulating multicultural friends to building authentic friendships.
Well, you know that police departments across the U.S. must be training their forces and having seminars on race and talking about racial identity, which is being talked about in the news. And a plurality of voices have joined the Black Lives Matter movement. What, Debbie, do you think this particular moment, this opportunity means for America going forward in a conversation about race?
Well, I think we've been here sort of many times before. And this is one of those classic moments where it's a crisis which presents an opportunity. And the question is this the moment where race will really be deeply understood, our racial history and the way it impacts individuals and the way we see ourselves and see the world around us? Or will it be a time to clamp down, increase controls, and double down on the oppressiveness that racism is? You know, there was slavery, that's off the books. There were Jim Crow laws, all kinds of segregationist policies, those are off the books. Now's the time to understand our history and the way it has impacted us psychologically, behaviorally, and in terms of the attitudes that we bring into the world. This is the big work. If we were in a marriage, it would be like, okay, the affair is over. Now let's dig into what that did to us. So it's a time to go inside, go deep, really understand the issue, and move forward in a multicultural way. Not white people saying, here's how we're going to move forward, but really white people letting go and allowing multicultural committees, forums, boards, agencies. I mean, this is why diversifying is important. And then leveling the conversational playing field, changing the conversational power dynamics so that we can recreate the way America operates as a multicultural society. And there are some people who flat out don't want that. I'm more interested in talking to the people who want it, but can't quite understand what undermines that intention.
Well, Debbie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Debbie Irving, she's author of the book Waking Up White. It's a memoir about her path to understand the role racism has played in her own life, despite her WASPy New England upbringing. She's going to be speaking at Gibson's Bookstore on Friday, September 18th. There's more information on the book and on the reading at Gibson's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you happen to be in downtown Concord during market days in June, you may have noticed a camera crew snaking through the bargain seekers, vendors, and beer gardens. At its head, Rick Broussard, author, editor of New Hampshire Magazine, and now co-director of Granite Orpheus, an experimental film project that began with two men and a humble mission. The production has since grown to involve a wide-ranging group of collaborators and to illustrate an important transformational moment for New Hampshire's capital city. Granite Orpheus wraps up filming this month, and Rick joins us now with more. Welcome back to Word of Mouth.
It's always great to be here.
All right, so humble beginnings. Let's get to those. What was the initial aim of this project?
It was to get John Heshen off my back. He's a wonderful filmmaker and photographer, and he wanted us to make a movie, and we'd gone through several variations on that concept, and finally we said, let's make something we can do in a weekend. We'll find a good setting and a good opportunity, you know, where we can opportunistically count on a lot of extras being around and an interesting set that's already laid out for us. And we picked Market Days in Concord. And a lot of things just coincidentally followed. For instance, I didn't realize how perfectly the city would be divided during Market Days. I knew that they were doing a lot of construction on the streets, but suddenly we have this incredible symbol of past and future for the capital city of Concord, divided right down the middle of Main Street, old and new. And here we are, as you say, snaking a camera crew amongst the beer gardens and the revelers.
And that weekend shoot, how long ago did that begin?
That was Market Days.
So end of June.
Yeah. So, and we've got one major shoot left to do and then some sort of mop up. But it was never supposed to be like this, Virginia. It was supposed to be easy.
So it's a kind of Franken-film at this point.
It's a Franken-film.
How did that happen?
I'm not exactly sure. I do think that the myth has something to do with it. Something about a myth, it's so open-ended and so it's so sticky to the brain that people just, they saw themselves in it and they wanted to be involved in it in some way. And so we suddenly had the small group that grew into a large group, and we had to find jobs for everybody. And we started with no script. And so we had to write a script.
So the myth that you're referring to is the myth of Orpheus. This is an old ancient Greek myth.
Correct.
Can you give us a summary of the myth?
Yeah, but it's going to be a reduction because it's a huge myth.
Reduction's good.
Essentially, it's a son of one of the muses who's the most talented musician, poet. He's actually a prophet of all time. He falls in love with a beautiful woman who is she's the daughter of Apollo. She is an oak nymph. And on their wedding day, he plays for her and she dances in the fields. And then shortly thereafter, she is bitten by a serpent and she dies and goes to hell, which, of course, was the ancient term for death, not a place of punishment, just where everybody went. And Orpheus is so determined to rescue her that he makes his way to hell and performs for Hades, the god of hell, a song which is so heartrending that Hades releases Eurydice with one condition, that she follow him out of hell back to the real world, and he never looked back to be sure that she's there.
And he just couldn't
he
do
just
it.
He just can't do it.
So he looks back.
He looks back, and he's drawn back to hell eternally. And, I mean, that's where the myth gets complicated, because there, in some versions of it, he is reunited with Eurydice and Hades.
Okay, so Eurydice is the woman he falls in love with, Apollo's daughter, the wood nymph.
Correct.
Now, why choose this story, the myth of Orpheus, rather than, I'm thinking, you know, Phoenix rising from the ashes as a symbol of transformation and optimism, I guess, for Concord's transition?
Well, I think it's a cautionary tale, which I think all the best stories are you know, they have a little bit of grit in them. And in this case, it's a story that's just stuck with me my whole life. I think, I don't know when I really first discovered it, but I know when I remember first learning of its artistic potency was when I wasn't in college. I was living near a college, and I would get to see movies at the campus. And I saw both Black Orpheus, which was a film shot in Brazil during during Carnival.
One of my favorite adaptations ever.
And then probably one of the most classic pretentious art films of all time, Cocteau's Orpheus. And Jean Cocteau was famously French and famously obscure. But of all movies to have memorized lines from, I was so fetched by certain lines from Cocteau's Orpheus that I've remembered them my entire life.
In French?
No. Sorry to disappoint. In the translated version. And so when John and I were talking about making a movie, I said, you know, it would be cool if we took some lines out of the old Orpheus and we put them in the mouths of some of our modern actors in Concord, New Hampshire, and see how that works.
And the others are just improvising all the other lines?
Well, we didn't wind up using too many lines from Orpheus either because the actors felt a little awkward using them. So instead,
give me an example.
One was, the bird sings with its fingers. And I don't know why Orpheus said that, but he did, and it just was a beautiful thought. And then he says, a single glass of water lights the world. And another one is, time travels faster backwards. So those three lines have always stuck with me. And if I ever just wanted to confuse people, I could produce one and sound. It sounded like I said something, but then when you think about it, he didn't really say anything at all, did he? So we figured we would use those lines, and instead they wound up in the lyrics to some songs that appear in the movie. There's a lot of music in this movie, which is, of course, appropriate to a movie about basically the patron Greek saint of music and art.
So you drew in these musicians as a part of your group of collaborators as this film has grown. Who are some of the others who've joined into the efforts?
Well, Andrew Pinard is a stage magician who we picked up along the way, and he's also a great actor and director, performer, blah, blah. He's everything, Andrew is, and he's fairly well known locally. So we typecast him as a magician or a street performer. Kevin Flynn, some people remember from his days on WMUR, but he's still a personality, and he's written for my magazine a lot, so I know him to be a great character, and we got him to be a balloon man, kind of an evil balloon man. And then the interesting development was when I enlisted a group of friends who are involved in the recording industry, a guy named Brian Coombs at Rocking Horse Studio. And Brian has always got a crop of great talent that he's working with. And he said, look, let us get involved. We'll do your Foley. We'll do your soundtrack. And I'm working with a singer-songwriter that might actually write your song, your great love song, because obviously a movie about a great love and a musician has to have a great love song. So we said, okay. And it turned out that musician is a guy named Alex Preston, who was a...
who's on American Idol.
He came in third. Third place is an odd place to come in on American Idol. It doesn't guarantee you anything. And Alex is trying to figure out what to do now with his career. And he voluntarily wrote for us, along with Brian and with another young man named Pat Gochez, who's in a great local band called Pat and the Hats, a song that is actually... I'm a big music fan. I think it's like a hit. This song could play well on the radio.
Okay, then, let's play it on the radio. This is a work-in-progress recording called I Would Save You. It's part of the soundtrack to Granite Orpheus.
I would stop time and see you arrive. Just to steal another moment with you and through the night, I would be your light just to guide you through the other side. If all of your fears came to light in the dark of night, all of your tears wash the dearest part of hope away. Oh, I would say.
So we've got that. So suddenly our game was just upped. You know, okay, how are we going to live up to this? We've got this great song. We've got all this talent. And we had this concept of making a pretentious art film in a weekend and slapping it together. The beauty of an art film, by the way, is if, you know, if there's anything that doesn't make sense, people assume that it was supposed to be that way. So suddenly we have to at least make enough sense to compose about an hour of film. And it may be longer. We were originally thinking a 15-minute film.
Wow. So, Rick, this is you. You know, you've authored books. You're editor of a New Hampshire a statewide magazine. And now director? I mean, is this a direction you want to go in?
I tend to find openings and then see how far I can delve into them. You know, the funny thing about the story, the cautionary tale of the story, is that if you reduce it to a single line, it's don't look back. And I think in many ways that's what the message of Orpheus is that when you're doing something great, you don't look back. And the reason for that is because you can't do something great unless you're totally committed to the course. And that little tentative moment is all it takes to, you know, eliminate all of the progress you've made to that point. So it's also an impossible standard. So I think it's like all myths, it's something that we're not supposed to live out, you know, in our day-to-day life. It's something that's supposed to inform our existence.
Well, then, since we're looking forward, what's going to happen in this film when it's finished?
That's a great question. I have an inn. My wife works for Red River Theaters here in Concord, and I know that we will get a showing there. It'll be the equivalent of a cast party where we bring everybody back together. And interestingly, a film scene has developed in New Hampshire over the past few years with the Snob Film Festival locally and the New Hampshire Film Festival. Both of those are candidates for next year, and I think we'll have a pretty easy path to get into one or both. And I guess then it just depends on how good it is. But it, like most things, you know, we can always live online. And I think that's not that different, I suppose, from, you know, from Hades, the online world. So maybe that's where you'll have to find it.
Another Myth in the Making with Rick Broussard. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rick Broussard, author, editor of New Hampshire Magazine, and now film director, or at least co-film director of Black Orpheus. You can find more about the film and its illustrious cast at wordofmouthradio.org. I would say you and I were star-crossed from the start. What tragedy the fairy tale in the story of broken hearts. So this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Before the break, we heard about Granite Orpheus, an experimental film project that is set to wrap up shooting in Concord this month. Since its inception, Granite Orpheus has pulled in an eclectic mix of notable New Hampshire collaborators, including the magician Andrew Pernard, Saad Hindal, he's an Iraqi artist living in Concord, local bard Brian Waldron, and Seacoast painter and filmmaker Simon Harling. Also working on the film is the set designer, Chloe Barcelo. NHPR's Sean Hurley caught up with Chloe to talk about designing something else entirely, a tiny house on wheels.
Chloe Barcelo and Brandon Batchelder work together in the movie industry, a team of sorts. Chloe designs sets, and Brandon builds them. But work is hard to find, and every new job means a move to a new place. For months at a time, they live in hotel rooms. For a year, they live in a 20-by-20 shed. All the while, and since the moment they met, they've talked about building a house together. They don't know exactly where, but they know exactly what. A treehouse.
I know with Brandon it'll be made really well, but it'll be really messy.
Oh, thanks. Word of the day.
Last year, they were hired to work on Amy in a Cage, an independent film shooting in Boston. A windfall of sorts. A big, well-paying job for both of them. It was then that a new pre-treehouse dream began to take shape of a tiny house on wheels.
It was the first time that we would ever have any sort of chunk of money as opposed to like scrounging from paycheck to paycheck. And we also would have materials because we knew we were going to build Amy in a Cage out of 2x4s that would end up going into a dumpster.
And so, last summer, with a chunk of money and 700 2x4s recycled from the movie set, Brandon and Chloe posted a curious request on Craigslist. Hideously smitten couple needs temporary build site for charming, innovative, tiny home contraption. Gerhard and Lynn Bloom in Hampton responded to the ad, and in September of 2014, the hideously smitten couple parked a somewhat hideous trailer in the Bloom's backyard and began to design a 300-square-foot house on wheels.
He made, 3D models with styrofoam at first to, prove that it would actually work. And then he went on to make renderings on Google SketchUp.
Many, many, many renderings.
Yeah. I think our first inspirations were Tudor homes.
But a sharply pitched Tudor roof, they soon realized, would create a lot of unlivable space.
So I kind of went back to the drawing board and just looked for something that would inspire me. And I came across steamer trunks. And there was something really beautiful and elegant about the shape. And that kind of drew me to gypsy caravans. So then we started drawing inspiration from ships, and it started to look like an old stagecoach.
They began to build in the fall, and when winter came,
we were able to borrow a kerosene heater from Gerhard and put a huge tarp over the whole thing. But even still, it was a constant battle. The winds were constantly tearing the tarps off, and
we really went stir crazy. But we were out here almost every single day in the winter, with a propane heater, cold. Hungry. Cold. It was really cold.
We're still cold.
Yeah.
We really are.
Still cold, but nearly a year later.
We're really close to being finished, but not quite finished. It's feels like a never-ending list of tasks that we have to finish before we can move in.
It's like a carrot on a stick. You're so close.
I think our motto for building this thing, too, has been, I didn't think it was going to take that long. Yeah. And it's been for literally every single thing that we've made.
With its wooden ship's wheel and system of roof-raising pulleys, their black and gold gypsy caravan / ship / train / steampunk steamer trunk would look perfectly natural pulling up to Hogwarts.
On the inside, it was sort of been like a little bit of a surprise, you almost expected, I think, to be dark and sort of mysterious on the inside as well, but I kind of wanted it to look like a jewelry box or like a Fabergé egg. You walk in and it's bright and airy and unexpected a little.
Above the blue front door they salvaged from an old restaurant is a blank space that will one day be printed with the name of their little house.
He wants to call it the Millennial Falcon, but that's not going to happen.
I call it the ship a lot, or ship house. I heard a kid call it a ship house. That was pretty cool.
For obvious reasons, Chloe says that's also not going to happen.
We don't intend to live in it for the rest of our lives either. Like some people that build tiny homes, they do it as a retirement option or something. But this is a 2-year plan for us. We eventually want to do a treehouse hybrid. That was sort of, when we met, that's what we started talking about way before this ever came into the picture.
We don't know where we want to settle down, but we know we want to someday build a house, our dream house. So this is an opportunity for us to kind of go around the country and sample different places and get a feel for it. I think the main concern is just to be around nature and good coffee. Mm-hmm. If we can find that balance, I don't really care where we are.
Yeah.
It takes about an hour to convert the house from travel mode to living mode. Using the ship's wheel and the system of pulleys, the roof is raised from 12 to 15 feet.
Babe, you just want to peek around and just make sure everything is working.
And once the windows are installed and the pop-out walls pushed into position,
you're surrounded by everything that you made. It's like you built a fort and you're staying in it.
In the next month or so, Brandon Batchelder and Chloe Barcelo will hitch their trailer house to a truck and pull it out of the Bloom's backyard.
The plan is to sort of find work and go to it, and just to keep doing that and keep seeing the country and keep working.
It will take them to their next job, hopefully near good coffee, and eventually, someday, into the neighborhood of an agreeable tree. Little boxes on word of mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green.
And you can see photos of Chloe and Brandon's homemade mobile home at wordofmouthradio.org. For a set designer, understanding space is everything. But understanding space-time? Well, that is another matter entirely. In this piece, producer Caitlin Esch of Philosophy Talk explores the growing influence of quantum physics on film and television.
There's a scene in the television series Fringe, it's the last episode of the first season, where a portal opens to an alternate universe and one of the characters slips through.
You're saying that William Bell disappeared into a different universe, like Dorothy going to Oz?
Well, Walter calls it an alternate reality. Do you understand?
Not remotely. You're saying that William Bell is not on this planet?
No, he is, just another version of this planet.
Sounds like the work of science fiction, right? But according to the Many Worlds interpretation of quantum physics, there are actually an infinite number of universes all around us, with infinite possibilities.
Odd as it may seem, it's a solution to a problem.
Chad Orzel is a professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and the author of How to Teach Physics to Your Dog. He says the rules of quantum physics allow us to predict what will happen in the future.
What those rules say is that objects can be in more than one place at the same time, for example. And the reason we don't see an electron being in more than one place at the same time is that it continues to be in multiple places, but the universe sort of splits. We effectively have a universe in which the electron is here and we see it here, and a universe in which the electron is there and we see it there.
This is great material for screenwriters.
Space, a final frontier.
In this episode from the original Star Trek series, an ion storm causes Captain Kirk and his crew to switch places with their doubles in a parallel universe. Only their doubles are evil. Captain Kirk realizes this when a bearded alternate version of Mr. Spock tortures a subordinate.
Mr. Kyle, you were instructed to compensate during the ion storm.
But I tried, Mr. Spock, I tried.
Carelessness with the equipment cannot be tolerated.
But Mr. Spock,
your
I tried.
Ionizer.
No, Mr. Spock.
Your agonizer, please.
No, Mr. Spock.
The interesting thing about that is, if you take this sort of theory seriously, there has to be that kind of universe out there. There has to be a universe out there where everything is the opposite of what we have here.
And that raises the question, how close are we to our alternate selves?
The Star Trek treatment of it is ultimately a little bit silly, but as an idea, that's something interesting that's out there, that if you're kind to animals, you nevertheless know that there should be some universe out there in which you regularly kick puppies.
While shows like Fringe and Star Trek raise interesting ideas, the scientific implausibility of colliding universes bothers Orzel.
That's a failing in shows like Fringe, is that the world in the other universe is really radically different. And yet, you have the alternate versions of the characters from our universe have the same jobs, and their parents are the same people, and they live in the same unrealistic New York City, two large apartments.
One small change in the past would lead to bigger and bigger consequences. The best example of this idea, according to Orzel, doesn't come from science fiction. It comes from the 1946 Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life.
I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all.
You've got your wish. You've never been born. You don't exist.
They work out in detail the effects of changing one thing in the past. And you know, it's not treated as a parallel universe that exists. It's just something that's shown to one of the characters.
Your brother, Harry Bailey, broke through the ice and was drowned at the age of 9.
That's a lie. Harry Bailey went to war. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor. He saved the lives of every man on that transport.
Every man on that transport died. Harry wasn't there to save them because you weren't there to save Harry.
In the film, we see that one man's existence impacts everything from the name of the town to the death of a brother. And even though it's total fantasy, it might just be realistic.
You see, George, you really had a wonderful life.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thank you for your listening time today, and there's much more to hear and explore on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. That's where we're collecting your favorite fall anthems. Also where you can ask a question or leave us some feedback for the show, or just share a funny GIF. We like those too. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.